go to Bureau of Labor Statistics and you look up certainly the U2 unemployment figures, that's what they're giving you, but then look up the U6 unemployment figures, and you'll find out that certainly, according to them, of the people who are unemployed, underemployed, or certainly have given up looking for work, you're dealing with over 14% of the population. And if you calculate this the way it was calculated, started back in 1990, and you can get these figures from shadowstats.com, shadowstats.com, John Williams' website, you'll find out that the real figures are over 22%. And we can see this certainly in what we're doing here. We're certainly the number of people putting in orders. Certainly our mail order business is way down. And this is true all across the country. The economy over in Europe is certainly contracting. The unemployment rate overall in the European Union is over 12%. They admit to over 12%. James Corbett, thank you very much for being with us. You pick up the story.
Well, thank you very much for having me again. And unfortunately, all of those, all of that data you were just citing is spot on. And it's absolutely staggering to look at the Eurozone unemployment rate right now. As you say, they admit to over 12%, 12.2% in September unemployment in the Eurozone, which is an astonishing figure. I mean, it really is the highest recorded unemployment rate in the Eurozone since those statistics first began. So absolutely, there's a pretty systemic crisis happening right now, and yet we still have the cheerers of this current economic situation who are coming along saying that the Eurozone seems to be exiting the crisis. So we're getting a lot of propaganda on that front, even as the average person in Europe continues to suffer under the results of this failed European integration project that's been ongoing for over a decade now.
And people don't understand. The only reason that we haven't had an economic collapse here is because they're creating $1 trillion a year. So almost $100 billion every month they're pouring into the economy here just to keep our system from collapsing.
While a storm cloud
Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this afternoon is James Corbett, who writes regularly for the International Forecaster. But we're simply talking about what's really going on in the world today. The real unemployment in the United States, if you take the Bureau of Labor Statistics' own figures, don't believe a word you read in the newspapers are lying to you. But go onto your computer, the BLS, or Bureau of Labor Statistics, look at their U6 unemployment figures. Those are their figures, and they will tell you that the U6 unemployment, and that is the unemployed, the underemployed, and certainly the people who've just given up work, and once you give up looking for work or you're over 6 months out of work, you're no longer considered unemployed, even though you are unemployed. But basically, you're talking about over 14%. And if you calculate it as they did back in 1990, why, of course, it's well over 22%. In Europe, they will openly acknowledge that the overall unemployment rate in Europe is over 12%. We're in the middle of a tremendous economic downspin. And the average individual doesn't understand it because the media is lying to people. Our guest today, James Corbett, giving us an international perspective from Japan. James, you pick up the story.
Well, you're exactly right about that, you talk about people not understanding what the real situation is because they're being lied to. But I think it's even more fundamental than that. I think it goes to the fundamental psychology of the marketplace in general, and what people want to believe. Because obviously, there is such interest among so many different parties for maintaining the status quo. There's a lot of people out there who would just like everything to remain the way it is right now, and thus don't want to look at any information that contradicts their idea of where the economy is or where it should be heading. And so there's a lot of, I think, fundamental resistance that develops among people to this. And I think there are different ways to visualize this. One way that I look at it is you look at a bowl, and if you have a marble, for example, if you put that marble anywhere inside the bowl, the marble will roll around, but eventually it's going to come back to the bottom of the bowl. It's just going to rest in the bottom. That's the equilibrium. And I think that's the markets. you can have incredible topsy-turvy events like what happened in 2008, the big economic collapse, and people's expectations of the market get thrown off. But eventually, people will come back to the center of the bowl. They'll think, well, everything seems to be stabilized again. Everything seems to be ticking along. I guess we can go back to business as usual. So people tend to want to always return to that place of equilibrium and just pretend that the markets are perfectly fine. Whatever the problem was, it seems to have been fixed and papered over, so we don't have to think about it anymore. Unfortunately,
hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sam is simply saying that most people really don't want to have to look and see what's happening. We don't like to know that the economy is bad and going to get a lot worse, that an awful lot of people are going to lose everything they have. Here in America, of course, they're keeping our economy going by creating $1 trillion a year. They tell, oh, well, things weren't so bad last year. I thought it was only $620 billion, something like that. And then suddenly one day, about 2 weeks ago, they suddenly increased the national debt. You know, suddenly almost $300 billion, something like that, $300 and a few billion. It's got us up to almost $1 trillion. They've simply been lying to us, ladies and gentlemen. They simply lie, but they don't want people to panic. They don't want them to see how bad things really are. But basically, they are going behind $1 trillion a year, year after year. They're keeping the interest rates artificially low, trying to keep our economy from collapsing. But more and more people are suddenly either being thrown out of work or having to take obviously jobs that get less hours or getting paid far less. And the economy is certainly in a downward spiral. Our guest is James Corbett, and you go ahead and pick up the story, James, and we can talk a little bit about China. We can talk about what's happening in other countries. Are other countries certainly in the same downward spiral that the United States and Europe are in? What are your thoughts?
Yes, many countries are, and I think that's because many countries, of course, are inextricably linked to the U.S. economy, especially, of course, China, which enjoys a very special trading relationship with the United States, as everyone in the United States, I'm sure, is well aware by now. Anyone who shops in the United States and looks at where their products are made will know that the U.S.'s great dependence on China's manufacturing capabilities. But I just want to pick up on the point that we were talking about just prior to this, because I think it's also important for people to realize that this this house of cards, as we put it, is a system that we often look at the specific numbers, how many trillions of dollars are being printed this year, or how many trillions of dollars of debt exist. But I'm going to say something a bit strange for an economic analyst. I'm going to say that the numbers themselves aren't as important as the trends that they indicate, because the numbers really are just numbers in a book somewhere. They don't really have a fundamental economic meaning, except through their relation to that fundamental market psychology we were talking about before. This is a system that, as long as everyone closes their eyes and believes in it and continues to participate in it, will continue to function until such time as it just becomes, as the debt burden becomes so great that people can't physically afford to pay their taxes anymore, and the system collapses that way. But for the time being, as long as the status quo can be maintained, they can continue pumping in more and more amounts of money. And in a previous generation, we were used to talking about the unthinkable, incalculable sum of billions of dollars. Now we're used to talking about the incalculable, unthinkable sum of trillions of dollars. And really, nothing fundamentally has changed. It is still a house of cards. It is still built on quicksand. The only difference is now we're talking about larger figures on these books. And again, it's still very much imaginary to a large extent, because, again, a lot of this money isn't making its way into the economy. So I want to stress that the entire system really is based on more on psychology than it is on actual underlying economic data. And unfortunately, as we were talking about earlier, people want to believe that the system is okay. They have a vested interest in believing, in many cases, that the system is okay, that it will survive at least long enough for them to retire and start picking up their pension and to go quietly into the good night. But I don't think that that is very likely, unfortunately, with the generation we see coming up now because of the situation that has developed over the course of the last several decades. And I think it's getting to the point where it's unsupportable in any way, shape, or form. And again, I think it will be the fundamental shift will come as a psychological reflection of what's happening rather than simply an economic or geopolitical event. When people start to see through that house of cards, I think that the system will change. And so that speaks to at least part of what I think might be the solution to this crisis, because we often talk about the crisis, we don't talk nearly enough about the solution, which I think has to be seen not in the realm of simply the economy as it exists today, but our perception of the economy and what is possible, how we could possibly change the fundamental underlying system. And until we start at least contemplating those types of ideas, I think we're not going to be able to really affect the change that's needed to bring about a different system.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Of course, we get Social Security. And basically, of course, the real inflation rate is somewhere about 8%. They're lying to us on the inflation rate as everything else. But this year, of course, they're only going to increase the Medicare about 1.5% to cover for inflation, lower than they usually have. Why? Because, of course, they realize they're going to have to start cutting back on Social Security payments. They can't actually cut the payment. They can just sit they cut the amount of money that they put out for cover inflation, and certainly as you get certainly higher inflation and less increase in your Medicare or your Social Security payments, effectively you're cutting back on what's going to be out there in the economy. People are going to have less and less money. And basically, of course, they can't increase taxes because if they increase taxes, people won't have any money to spend in the economy. In fact, we really see, and I don't know whether you're aware of this, James, but we have a mail order business, and certainly we've seen a dramatic cutback in the number of people buying as we have in the past. In the past, we had a lot of people buying a lot of things, but we're seeing a lot less of this. And as I talk to people who have similar mail order business as we do, everybody is seeing exactly the same thing. People are worried. People know something is seriously wrong, and people are hanging on to their money and not investing it. Are you hearing about this?
Unfortunately, yes. And I also, obviously, I have a lot of listeners and people in the United States who subscribe to my website or purchase DVDs. And I've noticed also that the declining number of people from the United States who sign up for subscriptions or purchase DVDs, and more people from other parts of the world. So I see that as well going on in my own business. But you mentioned Medicare there, and I want to pick up from that because I think this is a perfect case in point, especially at this point in time with Obamacare coming into view and people starting to realize just how atrocious the system really is going to be. And I think this is a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier, that people's perceptions shape the way that they see the world and what's really possible. Because the debate about Obamacare at the moment really seems to be centered around the website debacle and that people can't really sign up properly and some of the problems to do with the rollout of this program. But of course, the problems with the Obamacare program are much, much deeper than that and much more fundamental than that. And this is something that I covered on my podcast just last weekend, where I talked about how the Obamacare Act was in fact actually written by the private insurance industry. And this shouldn't be a surprise considering the way that it actually mandates American citizens to purchase insurance from these insurance companies. But it's actually documented on the record. Senator Max Baucus on the floor of the House when he was congratulating and thanking everyone involved with passing Obamacare, he took pains to specifically mention Liz Fowler as being absolutely crucial to healthcare reform in the United States. And someone who was on his staff. And when you look into Liz Fowler and her history, she was the former vice president of WellPoint, the largest private health insurance company in the world. So, again, we can document all of this and see exactly where this goes. And it goes much even further back in time to the founding, really, of the American Medical Association in the late 19th century and the rise of the robber barons of the late 19th century, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, who established their eponymous foundations and started to fund the American Medical Association and some of its programs to really change and alter people's perception of healthcare and what healthcare really was. And in the 19th century in America, you basically had two competing types of healthcare. You had allopathy and homeopathy, the idea of cutting and burning and trying to kill disease. And the other, homeopathy, is more about trying to cure it via stimulating the immune system via herbs and things like this. And the Rockefellers and Carnegies saw that there was a lot of money to be made in the allopathic form of medicine. So they funded the American Medical Association and its programs. And a lot of medical universities to this day still, of course, bear the Rockefeller or Carnegie names and bear that imprimatur, because obviously it makes a lot of economic sense for these robber barons to form the big pharma pharmaceutical complex industry. So this is really what is at the root of this. And you can go back to things like the Flexner Report, which was a book-length study published in 1910 under the auspices of the Carnegie Endowment, which basically shaped medical practice and medical education in the United States for the preceding century, and has really influenced the way that American healthcare is developed. And so we are living in a system that has been specifically constructed by people with vast sums of money, specifically for the purpose of getting that money out of the average American's pockets and into their own pockets. And this shouldn't be, again, much of a surprise to people who realize that Americans pay the most for healthcare of any citizens anywhere in the world. And
I think what's really so important, and I'm a physician, I practice medicine, I love medicine, I love the doctors, but they really don't know, they do not understand how dangerous the statin drugs are. Certainly there's very little, if any, correlation between cholesterol levels and good and bad cholesterol, and certainly heart disease. Certainly problems with heart disease come about because of inflammation. Basically, of course, so many of the statin drugs have complications, so many of the drugs that the doctors give their patients have complications. And they don't know about it. They don't have time to read all the scientific literature. And they certainly don't have time to, they depend upon certainly what they learn at medical meetings, financed by the drug companies, what they read in their medical journals, financed by the drug companies, what they learn from the detailed people who come to their office almost on a daily basis to tell them the glories of the drugs, financed by the drug companies. And unfortunately, an awful lot of people are dying unnecessarily by medicines that they know were lethal, and they've given them anyway. Certainly the Federal Drug Administration is part and parcel of the problem. And there's so many things. They're poisoning the air, they're poisoning the food, they're poisoning the water, they're poisoning our drugs, they're poisoning the vaccines. And the average doctor has no idea. We'll be back in a moment.
While storm clouds gather all across the sea.
Jim, as you go right ahead.
Well, I very much appreciate your perspective on this. Obviously, as a medical doctor yourself, you obviously have seen this from the inside. And unfortunately, the point that you ended on there is exactly the case where this system that's developed really is centered around around the ultimate aim of a lot of these families and groups in power, which of course is the eugenics depopulation idea that they have, that they want to basically eliminate vast swaths of the population. And what better way to do that than by inserting poison pills, whether figuratively or literally, into the mix? And of course, we've seen exactly as you say, the introduction of all of these types of medicines that are approved by the proper bodies that turn out to be deadly. And of course, we can look at things like the Gardasil vaccine and other such things, which taken as isolated incidents might seem like simple mistakes. But I think when we start to piece them together, we can see, for example, that the Rockefeller family and the Rockefeller Foundation have been funding the development of sterilization vaccines for decades on the record from their own documents. And again, I document that in my podcast. So I think that there is a much, much greater underlying agenda behind all of this. It's not simply a question of trying to make profit, although certainly the big pharmaceutical complex industry does make unbelievable profits from these poison pills that they're feeding the public. So again, I do appreciate your direct knowledge of this, and I think it just goes as part and parcel of what we're talking about in general, that most people want to believe that the system is okay, because the implications of the system being fundamentally corrupt are too much for the average person to handle. And again, it is that incredulity which will be our undoing, because if we can't understand that the system really isn't there for our benefit, it's really there for the benefit of the people who own this system. Until we understand that, I think that the idea of reform or actual change will be off of the table altogether, as people just basically put up their mental barriers to this.
Well, the thing is that there's some amazing things. I was an orthopedic surgeon. I will tell you that the total hip, almost a miraculous operation. I'll never forget when I first went into practice. I hated to see anybody with an arthritic hip come in, because we could put a new hip in, and it might work and it might not. Some of them did great, some of them didn't. But certainly with the advent of the new technology and artificial hips and artificial knees and shoulders and joints, I mean, truly miraculous arthroscopic surgery, truly miraculous, wonderful things that could be done. But of course, there's so many of the pills that the doctors give out that certainly do have many, many problems. And basically, of course, this is going to continue until people begin certainly challenging the doctors, begin studying themselves. And it's your health, ladies and gentlemen. You have to determine what's right for you. And your doctor may mean very, very well, but you want to evaluate everything he tells you. Never hesitate to get a second opinion or even a third opinion, because your very life or the life of your child or family may depend upon it. Well, our guest today is James Corbett. We're talking, of course, about the things that are happening certainly in our society, and basically, of course, where we're headed as a nation financially, because you can't keep certainly spending money you don't have. And the United States is having to create $1 trillion a year just to keep the whole economic system collapsing. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for James, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But we have very, very real problems. The whole world, most of the countries, the economies are contracting. And even in China, where, of course, we hear this phenomenal miracle, how they're certainly there. Economy's increasing. It's over 7% a year, and they're simply not being truthful. But here in America, of course, we're having very real problems. Europe is having very real problems. There are very real problems, certainly, all throughout the world as the economy is slowing down. And certainly, this usually, of course, precedes a war. This has happened time and time again when the world slips into recession, as it did certainly back in the 1930s. And, of course, the only way out was a massive war with literally millions of people either killed or wounded, and then the total destruction of existing society. So it could be built up again after, of course, peace was declared. And millions died totally unnecessarily in a totally contrived war. And I fear that this another war, very similar maybe, in the near future. But go right ahead, James. What are your thoughts? What's going on in China? What's going on in the United States? What can be done to remedy the situation?
Well, in fact, something very important is developing in China right now that probably a lot of people haven't heard about, but may, in fact, be extremely significant. It's called the Third Plenum, and it's a session of basically the new leaders of China. It's the third time that they've grouped together as the a plenary session of the Central Committee of China. And this is important because this is the session, the Third Plenum session, which in 1978 was used to unveil all of the market-oriented reforms in China that set it along the path that it's on today. And in 1993, the third plenum session of that particular group of Chinese leaders came out with and basically dismantled a lot of the state-owned enterprises at that time. So it is seen as a potential turning point in any Chinese administration, where basically there's a large expectations that a new change, a shift in China's policies will take place, and potentially some quite dramatic ones for the Chinese economy. So there's a lot of speculation going on right now what they may or may not announce during this session. Basically, it will last from the 9th of November until the 12th of November. So some very interesting things, and we'll have to keep an eye on what comes out of it. But potentially, what we could see happening are some pretty broad-based reforms, potentially surrounding such things as what is being tried out in the Shanghai Free Trade Zone right now, which is a special economic zone in China where they basically experiment with various reforms of various types. And one of the interesting reforms that the Shanghai Free Trade Zone has been experimenting with recently, that I noted in my most recent Forecaster editorial, was the idea that they're floating the possibility that China's currency, the renminbi, will be made completely fully convertible, i.e. people will be able to trade them freely without having to go through the government in terms of capital regulation or controls. And that's already taking place, or is due to take place very shortly in the Shanghai Free Trade Zone. And that is a significant step, because if the currency is made fully convertible, basically that means that it is one step closer to being a potential world reserve currency, a currency that could compete with the euro or the dollar or the yen as one of the big players.
See, James, when you say that it's completely convertible, are you talking it's convertible into other currencies, or is it convertible into gold or precious metals?
Into other currencies. So basically the idea here is that people can take that money out of the country and can change it into other currencies directly, party to party, and they don't have to go through the Chinese government for approval anymore, at least in the Shanghai Free Trade Zone. And some of those restrictions were lifted in 1996. Basically, capital account restrictions were lifted, but now they're talking about full convertibility. And that would be one of the prerequisites for making this a reserve currency. So we are seeing China taking baby steps towards that, and that's at least one of the things which may potentially eventuate from this third plenum session that they're about to enter into.
Well, now, we heard, Sydney, something about 2 weeks ago, where, at least as far as J.P. Morgan Chase was concerned, they were saying that you could not, if you had a deposit with J.P. Morgan Chase, you couldn't take your money over $50,000 out of the country. It was almost as if we were imposing certain exchange controls here in the United States, and you're saying how China may be doing away with exchange controls. Are we going to end up with a situation where there's more freedom in China than in the United States economically? What is happening?
Well, I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say it, but I think we are entering that type of topsy-turvy world, and there's a lot of capital controls and the idea of capital controls that are being brought into the U.S. market, and I think that's going to have significant ramifications.
You hang on, I guess, is that James Corbett will be back in a moment. Give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Jane, it seems that we live in a very, very topsy-turvy world, and the world, something I was raised in, no longer exists. At one time, of course, the dollar was stable. When I was certainly a boy, the dollar was stable. And yet, of course, the dollar has lost tremendous amounts of its value. We're talking about losing, it's only 80-85% of its value just during my lifetime. This is, of course, as it loses value, why everything becomes more expensive. Nothing has really become more expensive. It's simply that the dollar is losing its purchasing power. Would that be a fair estimate?
It certainly is. And of course, that can only be measured against factors such as the price of products that are imported from other countries. But again, if the other countries' currencies are also declining again, relative to the U.S. dollar, then it almost evens out in a way that people don't really see what's happening until something fundamentally changes, until something snaps. One of those inflection points that we could be seeing in the future is something, again, I wrote about in the recent International Forecaster editorial, where I was talking about the replacement of the U.S. dollar in terms of the petrodollar, the idea that oil bursts around the world are priced in U.S. dollars, as they have been for the last several decades, since the 1970s when Saudi Arabia went on it, and then all of OPEC went on the idea of the petrodollar. And since that time, of course, basically every nation in the world needs oil, so every nation in the world needs U.S. dollars in order to buy that oil, since oil is almost exclusively priced in U.S. dollars. And it's been talked about for some time, the idea that we might be moving away from the petrodollar. But I see the fact that China has just become the largest customer for Saudi Arabian oil over and above the American. In fact, oil imports generally, China has surpassed America now. I think that could be a significant turning point in terms of that move away from the dollar as the petrodollar. And I put this in that continuum of what we're talking about with China making baby steps towards becoming a reserve currency. And potentially, who knows, at some point in the future, oil bursts in Chinese currency or in the euro or in other currencies is at least feasible. And we know that every time that someone talks about this, they end up getting bombed and invaded, like Saddam Hussein back in 2000.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and basically we're living in a very, very uncertain world, ladies and gentlemen. Most people certainly have their money, their pension funds, with their money in bonds or in stocks, or certainly in annuities or all sorts of things where they hope it's going to give them security, especially as they grow older. But I would simply point out that you better start thinking about getting things into material things, because I fear the majority of people who have traditional investments are going to lose them. We have certainly a monetary system that's built upon quicksand, and basically these can just be destroyed within a matter of a few days, a few months. Basically, if we were to have an EMP attack, so literally overnight, the entire banking structure and financial structure of America would cease to exist. And if you doubt that, you need to get the report put out by the United States Congress based upon 8 years of research. It's entitled the 2008 Report on the Threat of an EMP Attack, the 2008 Report on the Threat of an EMP Attack. You can get it off the internet. If not, you can purchase it from us. It's over 180 pages, and they have a large segment in there on what's going to happen financially. But that's simply one example. Any one of a number of things can happen that would simply destroy the value of our currency and the life savings of the majority of the people listening to this program today, unless, of course, they've made alternative plans. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-295. And we have John calling from Northern Michigan. Hi, John. How are you listening to us?
Through shortwave.
Okay, very good. Would you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, Mr. Corbett, I heard a gentleman talking on a radio program regarding the oil dollar, and China is really desperate because they can't get they set up agreements with certain countries, but they can't get their oil through the Panama Canal in a large enough system to supply them. They have an issue there, and that I was always assuming that all of these countries in the world have to take their marching orders from the World Bank, and pretty much reset up China in the state of its state. That's the Mao and other leaders through the World Bank approval. Do you agree with me there? And that they are dependent really on still us as the backbone for their economy, because they really can't get the oil there fast enough.
I'm sorry, I don't think I quite caught the question. Could you?
Well, basically, John is just saying that it looks like we're moving into a crisis situation as far as China is concerned. They want certainly a stable supply of oil. They're increasingly looking to Saudi Arabia, because China is consuming more and more oil as their economy advances. He says, of course, that he believes, of course, that the World Bank and America had installed a Chairman Mao over there, and that China continues more or less under our domination, and that certainly most of the conflicts we think we see between China and the United States are simply contrived for the benefit of the American people. I don't know whether that's an accurate interpretation, but that's what I got. What would you say in response to that concept?
Well, I've certainly talked about this at my website before and gone through some of the ways that we can document that the Chinese government has been basically, there's been a close relationship, shall we say, between the Rockefellers and his minion Kissinger, going back to the time of Nixon and opening up of China in the 1970s. And I think that we have to see that there is absolutely that type of close relation. And that does absolutely mean that that a lot of what this conflict that's being hyped up right now between the China and the U.S. is smoke and mirrors. And at the very, very top, there are people at the top of both of those systems who are in bed with each other. So I think we have to understand that from a realistic perspective. But having said that, I think that doesn't actually negate the type of the type of back and forth, the squabbles that are going on right now. I think those squabbles are real. I think that the outcome is being decided and determined by the bigwigs who are waiting the table towards China. They want China, in fact, to become one of the dominant players in this system, because as people like Henry Kissinger have said repeatedly, China is the model for the New World Order. And whether you look at that in terms of the one-child policy and forced abortions and sterilization and things of that nature, or whether it's the controlled economy or what have you, this really is the model that they want to bring in. So it has to eventually be the winner in this struggle. In terms of, I heard something about oil and importing oil and the ability for people like China to do so. And I think it's extremely important that people take a look at the oil routes and the ways that oil and gas are brought into the country, including things like the port of Gwadar in Pakistan, which is something that they've been trying to open up and basically make some pipelines to bring the oil from the port there straight into China. But there's problems with people being incited to become revolutionaries in those precise areas. And they're incited by people like their friends in the U.S. Congress, who suddenly care so much about the local internal politics of foreign nations when it serves their geopolitical interests. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes there that I think people have to keep their eye on to understand what's really going on.
And I think that's accurate. I think it's very hard to understand all the intricacies of this, other than to understand that there are conflicting interests, but then many times, well, our leaders are certainly in bed with our enemies, and all you need to do is go back and look at World War II. We financed the Nazi movement all during the Second World War. It was American corporations, GE, GM, IBM, AT&T, Exxon. They were all over there, Ford were over there building the weapons for the Nazis that were being used to kill our boys, and nothing was ever done to the Americans who headed the Nazi corporation, the American corporation building the weapons for the Nazis during the war. In fact, most Americans don't know that we helped all the Nazis, and most of them, tens of thousands of them, escaped to South America with a rat line, R-A-T line. Nothing that we believe is true. Anything else, John, before we let you go?
I think we covered it, but I heard that they're trying to get a second canal in down in Panama.
Right. Apparently, they're Chinese that are going to put one in Nicaragua. Okay, very good. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you have a question for our guest, James Corbett. James, before we go on, would you like to tell our listeners how they can subscribe to the International Forecaster and how they can get in touch with you and certainly subscribe to your personal newsletter?
Absolutely. Well, people who are interested in the International Forecaster can check it out at the website, theinternationalforecaster.com. That's all one word, theinternationalforecaster.com. And there they have, for example, sample copies of my editorials and past articles that have been featured in the publication. It comes out twice a week, and it contains 30 to 40 pages of information, links, resources, articles, editorials. So definitely an interesting information resource. You can even get a free sample copy if it is your first time subscribing, and all of that, all of the details of that are available at the website. Or you can just write in by conventional mail, P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. That's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. And people who are interested in my own work can go to CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com, where you can find my podcast and interviews and videos. And, of course, you can also sign up for my own newsletter or purchase my DVDs, which is how I continue to do what I'm doing. So people can find out more information there at CorbettReport.com.
Now, my understanding is that the Chinese are suddenly investing a tremendous amount of money in America. What they're really trying to do is get rid of all these dollars they have, and they're buying up suddenly some rather large oil sand deposits in Canada. They're buying up homes in America and factories in America. Is this really going on? Is this really a factor in what's taking place economically?
It absolutely is, and I don't think it's just simply trying to get rid of dollars. I think they are definitely in the stage of trying to create strategic investments that will serve in whatever type of geopolitical or geoeconomic events happen down the line. And we can certainly see that they are investing huge amounts, for example, in gold mining. The Chinese have been buying up gold mines around the world now, which should tell us something about where they think the future of money is going. But also, I mean, as you say, things like real estate. We just recently saw Chase Manhattan Plaza bought by a Chinese company for $750 million. Just staggering amounts of money are being thrown around by the Chinese right now. Some of this is due to the fact that they can't use that money in their own country to buy real estate, for example, in China, because of the types of capital controls that the Chinese government is putting in place, basically to prevent the skyrocketing housing bubble that's taking place in Beijing and Shanghai and other places right now. So there are some domestic issues for why this is the case. There are also geopolitical and geoeconomic issues here. For example, China, of course, has a huge trade surplus with the United States, meaning they have lots of U.S. dollars. And to some extent, that's needed in order to, for example, buy oil in the on the global markets. But there's still, of course, just an excess of dollars that they need to use up in some way. So buying real estate in New York and places like that, they think will probably be a safer place to park that money for now, rather than just having cash reserves. And perhaps people can take a page from their notebook on that, because just like you said earlier, I think people should be looking into tangible assets that they can buy with their phony paper currency, because the paper currency will only last as long as the powers that shouldn't be wanted to last.
And ladies and gentlemen, remember, if we get into a financial crisis, you could lose the value of your life savings simply overnight. When we're talking about a day or two, you make your preparations now. Better to be 6 months or a year or 10 years too early than one day too late. Because, of course, I can remember a good friend of mine. He was German. His grandmother had been very wealthy. She'd had several million marks, and she kept them in her mattress. And basically, of course, following World War I, well, of course, they had an inflationary spiral. And basically, those millions of marks that gave her financial independence literally disappeared in value overnight. We've seen certainly the Rhodesian dollar. I remember when I was in South Africa, the recent Rhodesian dollar was similar, actually more valuable than the South African dollar. But it ended up about 1 trillion to 1. 1 trillion to 1, and the people who are invested in currency lost everything. They're impoverished. David from Dallas is calling again. Our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Hi, David. Question or comment?
Yes, Dr. Stan, and hello, Mr. Gordon. I was hoping we could probably change gears a little bit, because in my John Birch chapter, we're all focused really on the Obamacare. And if I use my employer to get my wife covered, Dr. Stan, that's going to cost me about $7,000 a year. I mean, that's just going to pass me out. You know, I mean, I'm not going to afford the... I'm just hoping I'll have enough money left at the end of the paycheck to have gas to go to work. I mean, I'm looking at the expenses, and I'm hoping to find an expense somehow. But I wonder if this Mr. Fulbert, if he would share his sentiments on how this is going to, you know, economically, it's going to crush a lot of people.
James, what are your thoughts? Because certainly David is calling from Dallas, just simply saying that the Obamacare is certainly going to just decimate them economically. They're going to have to put out phenomenal amounts of money, and certainly this is not that good insurance. A lot of it is catastrophe coverage. We may have to put up the first $5,000 or $6,000, you know, before you're going to get anything at all out of your policy. The people who run the insurance companies are going to make out like bandits, and the American people are going to be impoverished. What would you tell David from Dallas about this catastrophe? Is there any way we're going to be able to do away with it? or is it simply going to destroy the financial infrastructure of our nation?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Unfortunately, his experience is not uncommon at all. We've had reports of people whose insurance premiums are going up as much as 539% under the new policies. We have estimates of 16 million Americans losing their current health insurance policies as a result of Obamacare. This is a disaster, a national disaster, and the types of economic ramifications of this, I think Americans are only now becoming aware of. So I think that we're only starting to see the beginnings of the political backlash that's really going to take place. A lot of this, of course, has centered around the left-right debate, and Democrats have been rallying around their party to defend Obamacare. But I think once the sticker shock really starts to set in, even among the dyed-in-the-wool hardcore Democrats, I think they're going to start realizing that they've been had in a swindle by the insurance companies that, again, helped to write Obamacare. They helped to write the bill. So I think we should keep that in mind at all times. In terms of can this or will this be repealed in some way, in fact, there are still different court cases that are before the courts right now that could go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has ruled on certain aspects of Obamacare, but there are other legal challenges that are now before the courts that could eventually come to the Supreme Court and perhaps knock down the law. There are also, of course, the political incentive might be there to really start a campaign to get a repeal of this going, and perhaps there might be Democrat support for that as people start to see what's happening. I'm very interested to see how this develops as well, because I think there's no doubt that this is going to be a significant step towards the bankrupting of America and Americans generally. So I think it has to be stopped one way or another, and I think if the politicians and the Supreme Court and the Washington Beltway Circuit can't be relied on to do it, maybe the American people will have to step up and stop complying. I think there has to be non-compliance with this system at some point in order to stop the system in its tracks, and Obamacare might be a good point to start that non-compliance and simply refusing to go along with this system.
Well, I think one of the characteristic remarks was reported in one of the article I read, written by a liberal who actually said, you know, I thought this was great. I wanted everybody to be able to have health care, but I never realized that my medical rates were going to triple and I was going to have to pay for it for all these other people. So I think that's very characteristic. He wants free medical care for everybody, but he doesn't want to have to pay for it himself. And suddenly he's beginning to see what this is all about. Hey, thanks very much for calling, David. Let's quickly go to Frank, who's calling us from Salinas. Frank, do you have a question or comment?
I have a question. About how much, do we have a good idea how many dollars the U.S. dollars the Chinese actually hold?
Do we have any idea how many dollars China actually holds,
Well, we know that they hold about $1.2 trillion in U.S. treasuries. In terms of the actual currency that they hold, I'm not sure of the latest numbers on that, but I'm sure that we can find an estimate there somewhere online.
Well, I think there's probably at least another trillion and a half that they're holding. Anything else, Frank?
Japan holds a lot of U.S. treasuries.
Right,
also.
Right.
Are there any other countries in the world that hold a lot of U.S. dollars?
Basically, of course, as far as the debt is concerned, basically, China has $1.2 trillion of our debt. Japan has about $1.1 trillion. And then, of course, a lot of the other countries have 3, 4, 5%. Nobody has figures like China and Japan. Anything else, Frank?
Yeah, what is the current trade deficit with China for U.S.?
Have any idea what the current trade deficit is?
Not off the top of my head, but I can look it up in 10 seconds.
Okay, fine. We'll try to get to that. I haven't let you go, Frank. We're out of time. We'll be back in a moment.
While the storm clouds gather,
well, this is Dr. Stan here. Let's quickly go to Ren, who's calling us from Pennsylvania. Ren, do you have a question or comment?
Question and comment. Why can't we do what little Iceland did, arrest the criminal bankers who have 92% of the debt, and we can subsume that, set up state banks like North Dakota, and through the whistleblower and the IMF, she said like 60% of our tax taxes are being paid to the Vatican Bank and the other 40% to Britain. Why don't we just eliminate that, eliminate the Federal Reserve? They're the paymaster for all the criminal mercenary gangs that are running this government and this country and a good part of the rest of the world.
Because the American people never go along with it. We never had it so good. The American people aren't going to go along with doing what's logical. Not until, of course, they've been totally wiped out financially. The only reason that Icelandic people went along with it is because they faced total destruction. James, how would you respond to Rand, who's calling from Pennsylvania, and said, look, why don't we just simply renounce the debt, say we're not going to pay it, arrest the bankers, and do away with it? What are your thoughts? How would you tell him?
Well, I agree with your response there, Dr. Stan. Again, I think this comes back to that market psychology we were talking about earlier in this hour, where we're basically people are happy to go along with the status quo as long as they possibly can, because the change is usually more fearful than what they already know. So I think you're right. I think it will take some type of absolute breaking point to get people to go along with it. But I would much prefer to see the system that he's talking about. Even if it is state-owned banks, I think it's absolutely 100% better than the system we have right now, where of course it's private banks that own the Federal Reserve System and issue the money as debt owed to themselves. So there has to be a better way. And until the American people are better informed about what's happening and motivated to do something about it, unfortunately, I don't see any change coming anytime in the near future.
And Ren, your job is to get people to listen to our programs, to listen to Mr. Corbett, to get his information, to find out what's going on, and even get him to help finance and keep our programs, our stations on the air, and actually to expand our coverage. This was the best way. People are not going to be concerned as long as things are so good. Things are pretty good for about 80% of the population. It's that other 20% that are hurting, but believe me, they're all going to be hurting before long. Anything else, Ren, before we let you go?
No, that's it, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
God bless. Okay, and certainly a lot of people out there got great ideas, but until the people understand what's going on, they're not going to be concerned. James, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you as a guest.
Always a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it next week.